Real Six. What sport did you get involved with at Hyington?
When we first went there as entrants into the army, one of the first I remember in the, what was the, more a hall, that's the gym there, and that was that they used to just pair you up with somebody and you had to have a go at each other with boxing gloves on. But there again, if you're boxing, you never know who you're going to come up against and what you're going to come up against. Anyhow, it turned out I think there was two selected to go onto the boxing team, not me, no wonder. But apart from that, as regards the sport, there was PT, PT Sergeant was Mick Henderson, Sergeant Mick Henderson. And you would go on the field behind the camp and you would have various exercises, flinging your arms about and twisting your body and touching your toes and all that. And then, of course, you would maybe have teams similar to what you used to have at school, bits of relay races or things like that. You know, no equipment at all. It was just a case of what mix up between yourselves or running around places. I don't remember going even swimming, which I was a keen swimmer. But as regards sport itself, well, there was a box in the gym, or we'll call it the box, and he used to go and run and jump over that or turn somersaults and in general. What more or less PT same as you would get at school, you say that, or experience there. And maybe in the evenings you would go on a run. Of course, when you set off, it could even be a battalion run, not just a platoon company. And they would be told, right, the first half, or the last half that comes back, you'll go around again. So everyone was running, doing the best they could. I don't remember if anybody having to go around again, no. But it isn't just to put the fear up, you keep you going, I think.
You didn't get involved with soccer and cricket or whatever the sport was.
Not cricket, football. Yes, we used to have football in between the companies, different companies. They couldn't see whatever it was. Those matches were more or less held after duty hours. Duty hours more or less up to tea time, you could say, unless it was guarded and that. But yes, you would have your football matches. Of course, you didn't have football boots, you would just have your army boots on. And you'd no shin pads, and if you got touched with one of them, you knew you'd been touched as well. But it was a generally clean sport. If anyone was injured, I wouldn't say it was ever done on purpose unless it'd been two and they had it in for one or something like that. But
you didn't get involved in playing against other units or town teams or anything of that nature?
Between other units, I can remember that. But yeah, football matches, I'm maybe wrong here, but I just can't remember a football match between another unit just at the moment. I'm not saying there wasn't, I can't definitely say there was.
Dances or anything like that, were those held in the neighbourhood for you?
Well, there was dancing used to be held in the officers' mess, or maybe the sergeant's mess. But I think the only dancing as regards the privates was if one of the naffy girls would take you to dance round the canteen or something like that. But not a dance as you would think of it as a dance. No. Officers and sergeants. And of course, that meant that with the one piano that was in the camp, you would often get the sergeant asking for volunteers who can play the piano. So some would volunteer, of course. The one that played the piano, it was maybe to push it up from one company to another. So they got caught that way. Of course, I remember my dad telling me, he said, never volunteer for anything in the army.
You've mentioned ladies in the naffy. Did you have ATS girls on the camp doing any?
There were ATS girls there, and their main job there was in the cookhouse. I'd say they didn't used to come round and clean your sleeping quarters and make your bed. Cooking duties mainly, I would say. But in the naffy itself, there were members of the naffy. Navy, Army, Air Force Institute, and there was three or four of them, I think. There wasn't a lot there, no. But the ATS school, there wasn't really a mixture of get together after duty and that. It was seemed to go their way. They weren't billeted in the same barracks as us. It was just close by with some private houses, which are still there today. They weren't duty in these houses.
The ROF, the Ordnance Factory, was just down the road, wasn't it, from your place at Hinton?
The Ordnance Factory and the Aycliffe.
Did you get involved with that in any way?
No, none at all. No. I mean, what is now Newton Aycliffe was more or less fields, and that when we were up there. But, to be honest, I can't even remember it being mentioned when we were there. But I don't know what year it was actually became operative, the Ordnance Factory at Aycliffe.
How long were you at Hinton?
Let's see, it was 41, 42, around on aerodromes. Well, it would be in 1942 when we were moved from Hinton to Barnard Castle. Probably about the middle of 42, as near as I can remember. And then we were with Barnard Castle until July 43,
It started with Colonel MacBain. Had he been superseded by the time whilst you were still at Hinton?
Yes. It was towards the parting date from Hinton. He was replaced with a Colonel Fillingham.
Did you get Colonel? Did you get Colonel Jeffries at some stage?
Colonel Jeffries, yes, that was at the latter stage of our service in England. He joined us at Barnard Castle.
So you moved to Barnard Castle in 1942, and by then you were pretty well trained.
Oh yes, yes, yes. We've learned most of the things. In fact, 42, well, I suppose, looking back, we'd be ready for our first red stripe on our arm. 1 year's good service. Good service stripes. Others used to call it one stripe for undetected crime. But that's another story.
You were very young, as a battalion, of course, in age. Were you young, enthusiastic, fit?
Oh yeah, I was one thing, I was fit. I think I mentioned earlier about we used to do PT and that at a friend's house and then go for runs round the outskirts of Darlington. And, many nights we'd think nothing of running 10 miles, running just taking off. So when I went into the force, I wasn't the fittest by any means of them, but I was reasonably fit. I remember being once on a route march and they put me in as a section leader, and the lads were lagging behind a bit, and I can actually remember running to the rear of it and then running back to the front, and the lads were puffing. Yeah. Well, yes, I used to take care of myself, and as regards the exercise and that, we used to do, even with and the PT side of it, I used to do them without having to keep it.
Was there a strong esprit de corps, identification as being a particularly good or special battalion?
No, I think if you wanted to use it, if you were good at boxing, you used it. And I remember too, they got promotion, it was more or less through them being in the boxing team. I think that, but apart from that, I wouldn't say that there was any emphasis put on how good a chap was, this, that, and the other. You were all expected to do it, to get on with it. And that.
Had they at any time in the early training days taught you about the history of the regiment?
Oh, yes, it was originally 68th of Foot of the Gunham Light Infantry. I'd, there used to be the odd lecturers, Wallace came in with your training routine and go through, see, on the colours of the battalion or the colours of the regiment, there was the battle honours were on the flags. And they, even there, they were written on the wall, I think within the dining room as well, which had a stage at one end, I remember, and each side of the stage was written different battles which the villains had been engaged in.
Were there any educational lessons or courses given, particularly, say, towards promotion?
Yeah, you have an education officer. Every week or something like that, but occasionally there would be a get-together and he would try and put in the pictures what was happening more or less with current affairs, what the position was abroad and how the war was going. He would do that. Also, he would educate you in the means of map reading and find a way of reading maps, getting so, or even looking at the stars, the North Star. We won it, I remember going across the field one night and one of the lads says, oh, so there's that North Star. He said, oh, well, I'll lead you the cups here. And we'll tell her. And the next thing was, he'd gone into a slit trench that had been there for training. He fell into that, up with star reading.
Where did you go to in Barnard Castle?
Barnard Castle, we went to... there were numerous camps around Barnard Castle as well, but the particular one you said where we go to was Westwick Camp. A Westwick Camp would be about a mile and a half or 2 miles out of Barnard Castle before you would get to Barnard Castle from Darlington. And next to Westwick Camp was the Battle School, what was called the Battle School. And then there was Humbleton and Deerbolt Camp. Was not camp, I think there was different camps around the back. It was really a military area, if you could say there.
Can you describe your Westwick Camp to me?
Well, Westwick Camp was the main road from Darlington to Barnard Castle. It was situated on the right hand side, and there was a bit of a track, or a rough road went down to it, maybe a couple hundred yards, 200 yards long. On the left, as you went into the camp, was the guard room. And the camp was built on sloping land. There was the guard room, as I said, on the left. Going down the camp, the cookhouse and dining room was on the right. And carrying on down from there were a few billets, from what I can remember, to get into the bottom of the camp. Billets went along and round to the left as you were facing it. In the centre of the camp was the educational hut that was being on about there, the education officer. Quartermaster's stores was placed sort of a half left from the guard room. And just behind the guard room was the MT sheds, the transfer yard. And between the guard room and the quartermaster's store, I think, was the parade ground. We used to do the parades. The good camp as well. He had the ablutions, there was the washing huts and all that, so he had hot and cold water there.
Were they wooden huts?
No, actually they were brick-built huts. Inside was the bunk beds, up and down, bunk beds. There was a round cast iron stove, more or less in the centre of the hut, the winter time, if you were going to get a bit of warmth from that. And windows in, where of course you used to have to put up blackout, not curtains, but they were a made up square section of material and framed with wood, and they were placed and fastened to the window frames right down, and then you were back out.
How many would there be in a room?
In the room, you'd need to get a platoon in, 30.
Similar situation to what you had at Hind.
Yes.
And the same situation for keeping it clean and so forth.
Oh, yes. I never saw cleaning it coming to the capital, you know. It was all done. And the officer there is, whoever was inspecting it, no one around us, they would always find a bit of something somewhere that needed attention.
The usual kit inspections that were going on?
The usual kit inspection, but getting what actually, why we were sent to Westwick Camp was to become a demonstration battalion. And this demonstration battalion used to go out onto the moors, and from the battle school, which was the next camp, there would come various officers of all sorts of allied nationalities. And they would come to see us actually demonstrating a battle. I don't know if you want to tell you about that.
If you could, yes, tell the kind of things that you were doing.
Yeah. Well, that's it, mainly the duty that Bandicoot, apart from North Guardia, that was this demonstration battalion for Allied officers. And there were higher ranking officers as well. But to give you an instance, so many of the personnel from the 70th would put on German uniforms, proper German uniforms, helmets and the lot, and go out onto the moors, which was nearer to a place called Bowes. It was that, but it was just moorland. And the different exercise would take place. The officers would be placed in a strategic position, and one test for them, I remember, was that these lads in the German uniforms, they would go out previously and lay down in different positions throughout the morning. And then they'd ask the officers, what can you see? Can you see any personnel out there? And after that, each one was to stand up in turn. And it was amazing that the officers commented they never thought of that many men laid about in the moors, just camouflage from the normal grass and that. Another exercise was what they called Battle Hill, and going over the moors, it would go to a raising land, which was the Battle Hill, and then an attack would have to go onto this from leaving maybe where the officers were to a case advance. And all these exercises were done with live ammunition. Even artillery would come over, and they advance under what we call a creeping barrage, where the artillery would direct the shells to land ahead of you. And as you advanced, after the first salvo, they would then lift the guns up to a higher range, and you would advance more or less to where the first salvo had landed. Cover there and sort of carry on like as a creeping barrage. What was it all? You get to a point where they would have machine guns, the Vickers machine gun, set on fixed ground, maybe about 3 foot high, I would think it would be firing, and you all had to crawl underneath that in turn. And eventually, when you got towards this Battle Hill, at the top, it was fixed up like hayfield sacks in frames, as for bayonet practice, and you would do an assault on this and go in with a bayonet attack. There was one dispatch rider there, he actually got a bullet through his helmet there, just, as I say, using live ammunition. And there's a cemetery just outside Barnet Castle, Stafford, and in there there's three Dunamite infantry who were actually killed on these exercises.
Mm. Were you there when that happened?
Yes.
How did that occur?
Well, so there's one of them, a sergeant, I forget his name, but he's in the soldier there, and he was killed by a grenade. I think what he was trying to demonstrate was to release the pin of the grenade and throw it. Unfortunately, didn't throw it quick enough. Okay. And another one, he was killed by small arms fire from some direction. No, I don't know. I don't know exactly what happened to the third one, but the graves are still there that, in the start of the cemetery.
Were you still dispatch riding at this time?
Yeah.
So what would your role be in that kind of training?
Well, at that time I was the commanding officer's dispatch rider, and wherever he went in his car, staff car, which was a Ford, an old V8 engine, and I just used to have to follow him around, and if there was messages for him to take back, or maybe they wanted them to advance to another position, or hold up the company, or dig the trenches, get in there, used to have to take the messages back to them. That was the main duty, just dispatches, instructions, for those concerned.
How were you armed? You wouldn't be carrying a rifle with a motorbike?
No, you were given a revolver.
Did you get any opportunity to practice firing it?
I fired it once, I think, and that was it. But I thought from that,
In these field tactics battles, how was the battalion trained? Were we still in the days of advancing in lines in the same as they did in the First World War?
No. You see, even the trenches in the First World War, no doubt the same. There was these long trenches, but there was nothing like that, of course, in the Second World War. What it was slit trenches. They would be in staggered positions through whatever the line was. And I suppose basically it was near enough to like a grave, you could say. It's not as deep, of course, but like the grave, there would be normally two men to a trench. That was done in the training as well, digging in slit trenches. Even as a dispatch driver, you would have to do that yourself. You would have to place the pike in the best covered position possible, and you would use it again.
And you had a digging tool with you, did you, for this?
Yeah, they used to call it a trenching tool.
Was it much good?
I didn't use to carry it when I was riding the bike and that. Well, it would do its job, of course, where it was softish earth or that, like a T-shaped, so that the handle on it would be about a couple of foot long, I would think, 2 foot long, and the head of it was more or less a spade, and like almost a pick shape to dig in the harder stuff. But it was wasn't easy work, digging it.
And movement into action, was that on fire and movement with jumping, one attacking you, jumping another, was that it?
You could be given a number, if you were up to two, we say 1 to 30 there, and you would maybe get the word, an order come, advance by numbers. And of course, 30 men in different positions, the number would come out, maybe number 3. So number 3 would go in, he'd have to try and advance a bit. And then maybe go to 20, and back to number 1. And each time that one person would advance a bit, advance by numbers.
Did you get involved with working with tanks in this battle school?
Yes, that the full complement of armaments, you could say. Tanks used to advance behind tanks, and at one stage they did try putting a sledge behind the tanks and put an infantryman on there. I don't think it was really great success. It was done. But then, as I say, you would advance behind tanks and so you had live ammunition. There was a write-up in a paper, I don't know whether you've ever come across it in your travels, and they reckon that the live ammunition used by the Durhams of this training battalion was more than what a battalion in action was using.
So to a degree, you were in effect putting into operation lessons learned throughout the early part of the war.
That's right, oh yes. There's lessons learned through active service. Well, that was good. band at Castle Sundown when these soldiers were going out in the German uniforms. Some of the locals used to think they were real Germans. They used to be shouting and whispering and all sorts of them, thinking they were real Germans because they were dressed with a past.
You said there were many high-ranking officers. Do you remember any important visitors coming to see you?
Well, I suppose the most important visitor at that time was not actually on a course, but it was Winston Churchill. I'm actually on a photo of him when he was at Barnet Castle. And one of the comments, it's funny, I just read through to the day that an officer said, oh, this is the 2-inch mortar. And apparently Winston replied to him, you mean the 2.3 mortar? That's put him in his place. But that was it, Winston Churchill.
Did you get close to him when he was there? Did you see him?
Not really, no, to be honest. No. And as regards other officers, well, that were on courses there, I honestly couldn't say any of any of them. But there was even up to generals that had come there. And of course, with some of the foreign visitors, some of the ranks I wouldn't identify, couldn't identify, I didn't know what they were.
It must have been pretty arduous work that you were carrying out.
Oh yes, you have to put your backs into it and get it, and it, of course you would get a break halfway through the day. You'd only get a couple of slices of bread and maybe a bit of cheese and a cup of tea, and that was your meal for it.
Was still basic army food as you'd been getting since you joined.
Oh, yes, it wasn't a very big menu of the service life. A lot of it was repetitive.
But then again,
people were fitter then. I mean, dear me, so they were fit enough. It was more than the civilian ration as well, of course. What you got was not much more. Never sufficient. You'd always eat more. Obviously, you'd leave a table and serve over a bit more than they made you did.
What was Fillingham like?
Fillingham in one of the old soldier class. Amongst officers, I've learned through going to reunions that he wasn't really liked. He was a funny person, really. For instance, he once pulled me up in Barnard Castle on the, I think I was walking across the plate on soldiers, so I ended up to attention. He said, tell me the Ten Commandments. Well, I suppose I was a bit of a fizz with him, that I could remember. I knew some of the commandments. He says, right, he says, go and learn your Ten Commandments, he says, and when you've fully learned them and can tell me them, you will stop me in the camp. Because you weren't allowed to go straight up to an officer. If the officer spoke to you, you could speak to him, but you could never speak straight up to him. He said, learn your Ten Commandments, he says, and come straight up to me, and I want to hear you say them. I did that, and of course went to home, and he just says, right, he says, don't you forget them, off you go. And that was it. I just saluted him in a way.
You said that you weren't allowed to make a direct approach to an officer. Had that to be done through an NCO, if you wanted
then
to say?
Through an NCO, yes. If you were in a position where, say, the officer was with you, it was a bit lax there, of course you could. But on parade, if the officer was inspecting you, you had to speak, but you could say a permission to speak, so if he passed some comment on you, such as, I know once I had some studs out of my boots, and the permission to speak, so I said, that's because I was on the driving course for driving lorries. Even on the Dad's Army, he's made that permission to speak, so that's often put up, but basically that was...